Welcome to Culture Unfit. My name is Nikia Riviak, and if you've ever felt constrained by culture's expectations of who you should be, what you should do, or what constitutes good, bad, or ugly while showing up in the workplace, then this podcast is for you. Welcome, my beautiful misfits.
Welcome back to Culture Unfit. This is episode 2, season 2, a continuation of the conversation between Elise Kane and myself. And in this episode, we delve a little bit more deeply into this notion of fit. What it is, when it is something that someone feels on the inside versus something that is actually happening in an organization. And we hope to leave you after this conversation with some tips and tricks to approaching situations in which you feel like you don't necessarily fit. So without further ado, let's listen in. Now, I think the natural next question for me is around this notion of fit. And you know, in particular, when I hear the term culture fit, I'm fascinated by it. I myself use it all the time. But when somehow applied to me, it doesn't always feel good. And so I've struggled with this notion of fit and do I fit? And I think a lot of us do, but don't talk about it in my entire professional life. But I'm curious about what the word or the term culture fit means to you or has meant to you when you had the responsibility of looking for people who fit.
So I think there's a big difference between a company's culture and the idea of fitting, right? So let's go talk about Colgate, you know, when we were there, right? Because I don't know what's happening now, but when we were there, Colgate did have a culture of, they like to say caring, and maybe, you know, caring is the right word, but the culture was where people supported each other. It wasn't very competitive. People were, in general, weren't backstabbing. I know a lot of companies where people won't help you because you're competing. At Colgate, if you ask somebody for help, they stopped what they were doing and they helped. And I believe that while I absolutely know that relationships build in other companies as well, but I believe that more people at Colgate got married than other companies, partly because Colgate allowed it. And people build very strong, deep friendships at there because of that as well. And so they had this culture of being collaborative and supportive, which to me is different than fit. And while in my life, in my professional life, I am guilty of saying that person doesn't fit. And at some point, I just realized that that is unhealthy. I feel that because, one, if you're looking for everybody who fits, then you have no diversity. And of course, I'm talking about age diversity, gender diversity, ethnic diversity. But in addition to that, it's just diversity of thinking. So if somebody thinks differently and their manager perceives that as not fitting, and I say, you know, you need to look for a new job because you just don't fit, it's really negative. When there are cultural differences, ethnic differences, you have a company that's primarily white men, right? Older white men. And then you bring in somebody who might come from a different culture, and they aren't going to fit the same unless they change how they come to work every day and wear a mask. They aren't going to fit your mold, right? And so you're going to be a little uncomfortable with them because people like spending time with people that are like them. And so if you are not like them, then it's very easy to use this idea about fit. And I've just heard it used in the organization to not promote people or to let people go too many times to make me comfortable.
It sounds like it became weaponized, the word, right? Like a short, you know, instead of like really facing the truth, it's like, oh, this person didn't fit. And behind the word or the term were a lot of biases, a lot of like closed-mindedness, but you almost didn't have to go much further. It was a way to end a conversation.
You didn't. Yes, you didn't.
So what about how you felt about yourself? Early days at Colgate, you know, throughout, like when you think of that term and you think of Elise Kane.
All right. So just some background on me.
Yes.
I probably came from a lower middle class family. My father, from the day I was born, my father worked two jobs and to support the family. We lived in an apartment. We never even owned a house. It was six of us in a two-bedroom. And my siblings and I all worked full-time while going to school at night, and that's undergraduate and graduate. And I'm digressing a little bit just to tell the story, and then I'll get back to this fitting. When I was at Weight Watchers, the president came to me one day and said to me, "Why are you not going to as good a school as Julie is?" She was working on a different business, but she was the same level as me. She was a peer. And I said, "What makes you say that?" I said, "She's going to St. John's, which is not the greatest marketing school." And he said, "Well, her tuition is whatever it was, and your tuition is only whatever it was," because I was going to a CUNY school. I was going to Peru. And so that made me realize, and he was not from New York. He was not even from the U.S. So he didn't really know. And even if you're not from New York, I don't think you understand the CUNY-SUNY system and the idea about, you know, public colleges and so forth. And, you know, he was even twice removed because he wasn't even from the United States. But that was very jarring, right? So just by submitting my tuition reimbursement form, I got asked why I'm not going to a good school. So now I go to Colgate, and everybody around me seems to be, at least, you know, blonde, Midwestern. Now, I'm sure that they weren't, but they were all from the best schools, because that's how we did the recruiting, the 10 best schools. So you had people that were from these schools. I was very uncomfortable. I was very uncomfortable. I did not want people asking me where I graduated from. Now, you might say, "Well, how did you get hired in there?" I got hired in there because they were different criteria for market research people than marketing people. But I was surrounded by the marketing people. And for a good number of years, I was uncomfortable. And then when I realized that, you know, that I was more strategic and smarter than some of these guys, I actually started to feel, you know, a little more comfortable. Plus, I had I started to have a reputation, and, you know, people weren't asking so much about school and stuff. But I was uncomfortable for a very long time.
Now, how did you manage through the discomfort? I mean, nowadays, the term imposter syndrome is the label that's used to describe this feeling of perhaps being, and I don't love it, an imposter. Like you're somewhere that you're not supposed to be, you know, and that place is often better, more senior when applied professionally. So like, how did you survive it? It could often feel crushing. So to have gone through it for a number of years means that you, how did you do it?
Well, I mean, okay. So first, Again, I think there's a difference between this imposter syndrome, which I completely understand and I realize, but that more has to do, I think, with, you know, do I deserve this job, right?
Right. Okay.
It wasn't about deserving the job. It was just about the environment made me uncomfortable because of the fact that there were all these people from the best schools. If they could afford the best schools, I mean, some of them went on scholarship, but they certainly were more affluent than I was. And I would just come home and I'd just shake my head and say, I just feel like I'm working in, you know, some other world, because most of my friends had gone to CUNY. My friends from high school, they all kind of were in the same socioeconomic level that I was on. So many of my friends did not go away to college, and they went to CUNY schools and such. And so I just was not used to that. But I also, and they still are recruiting that way, or at least, again, they were when I was there. And, you know, I certainly have met many graduates from Baruch, you and me being two of them, and many more than us, that are as good as the people coming in from the top 10 schools. And again, it's an unfair way to assess people. And right. Again, when you're recruiting people from the same schools year in and year out, again, you're not getting diversity of thinking.
Totally. Now, there's, in what you're describing, a feeling that you had because of the lived experiences that you experienced. Did you have any signal from how, like, the organization was perceiving you? Were there any signals or ways of treating you in meetings? Or, you know, we think about the markers of recognition or incentives, like promotions, etc., that said to you that you were different or came from a different experience? Because what I'm trying to reconcile is the internal feeling of fit or lack thereof, and then the external signals or markers of fit or lack thereof.
So for me personally, I was so junior that really was irrelevant. But as I got more senior, and I'd be going to succession planning meetings, there was discussion about, where did this person go? You know, as we were talking about people and promoting people and moving people, they're not, and it wasn't an organization criterion, but there were several managers, not many, but several marketing GMs that would say, where did they graduate from? And so I do think it, for the marketing people versus market research, I do think it impacted. They were all from the best school, so I don't really know what they were looking for. I mean, you know, is it Yale is better than Harvard? Harvard's better than Yale, NYU? I don't know what they were looking for exactly. But, you know, again, if they brought in somebody for the GMDD program that did not go to, they decided to open it up, right? And they brought somebody in from Baruch. I think that would have limited them, if depending on their managers at some point.
Yeah, it's so true how much these decisions are local, meaning like made by a manager, right? So like an organization is really a collection of managerial decisions. And if all those managers make similar managerial decisions, then it kind of becomes the norm and the culture. But I'm going to, if you'll humor me, use the STAR technique to ask a question, because I have a particular case in mind, but I don't want to ask it outright. So I'll back into it. So if you could tell me about a time where you brought someone in whose dress, way of getting ready for work and showing up in the office, didn't jive with the expectations. And this is, we're just going to, for the purpose of having a great conversation, make it a man who you know, back then, Colgate, I don't know what it looks like now, but Colgate was very corporate, right? There was an expectation that the men were wearing suits. I think at some point it evolved to like, you don't have to wear a tie, but for a long time you had to wear a tie. So tell me about a time when you brought in an individual who perhaps wasn't rocking the expected suit look, but, you know, it wasn't necessarily affecting performance or anything. Like, how do you navigate in that situation where there's a misfitness? That person may not even be aware, but yeah, the organization is making judgment calls, but you still need to sort of, as a manager, guide them in the right way.
Yeah. So particularly later on in my career, right, when I had a lot of confidence, that stuff just really, really annoyed me, right? Because the person, it, you know, could be doing the best job. So you want me to speak specific as I can, because you asked me a star question. So I had somebody working for me who, very, very bright, started off as an intern, and I told the organization they had to hire him, and he did not dress the dress code. And even when he wore a tie, it didn't necessarily look corporate, I guess. And so I started to get feedback that he needed to get with the program. And I pushed back because I felt that it was not impacting the work. I did have a conversation with him about, you know, kind of looking around and thinking about, especially when we had meetings with really the very high senior people. But he didn't care about clothes. It was the way he dressed. He didn't even understand, you know, what I was saying to some degree. And it, you know, in the end, to be very honest, he did not change the way he dressed. And I do have to say that in this case, because this is not always the case, his competency did win people over, but it didn't stop them in all of these meetings that when we're talking about personnel, saying, you know, that he needs to dress differently. And I finally said to a senior male, well, you know what, then since you feel this way, then you talk to him, because I don't feel that way. And so it's hard for me to kind of express with the same kind of urgency. And B, I think it's better for a male to talk to him about it and provide the advice that they need. And you know something, that senior male never did. And that senior male was not shy, but when it came time to talk to this person, it didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what, I mean, I do know what it is, but I continually wonder what it is that causes people to want to say something, especially in business settings where really in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't make a difference. But I do think this is just based on like my experience. It's a reflection of some discomfort that person has with their own self, right? Like, you know, when you see somebody who really is doing a great job, likable, but there's the need to provide a kind of critical feedback that sometimes is not going to help that person be better in their job. It's more a reflection of their own something. You know, I remember getting feedback through the grapevine that I presented like with too much like Nikkeianness, too much opinion, not enough fact. And I'm in research, so you always have to be objective. But I do think that my personality, and this is something I didn't know then, but I could say it now, was so different. You know, I'm not extroverted, but I know that I could be charismatic when I need to. And sometimes you really need to sell in the insights. But it broke some molds in people's minds. And it does take either having a really astute manager or high self-awareness to take that feedback and know that really, because of who is sending it, perhaps, and the tone of it, you should take it with a grain of salt. I mean, all feedback, you should, you know, thank you for it, and then you reflect on it. But there is a lot that comes through that feels very much, I don't know what the word is. It's not tone deaf, but it's just sort of like not really about the individual doing a better job. It's identity based. It's, you know, it's.
Well, you know, the thing is that I've gotten a lot of good feedback in my life. So I don't want it to sound like feedback is negative. It is not. I have gotten a lot of feedback that I thought to myself, oh my God, this is true. And it needed to be addressed. So by no means do I mean all feedback, but certain feedback, like the way you present, or the way this person dressed, or that kind of feedback. You said this before. It's more about the person, right? And who the person giving the feedback, because they're uncomfortable with something. Now, yeah, if it was 1990s, I do think that the feedback to this person would have had to be different, because getting promoted was partly based on how you looked, right? And how together you looked, and how, you know, professional you looked. I mean, think about all the women, not me, wearing their navy blue suits and their white shirts with their big, you know, big bow tie things. And so I do think there was a time when how one dressed would have affected this person's getting promoted, but not at the time when this feedback was being given.
I mean, I'm happy that you existed to advocate, first to push back, and then to advocate and be like, you know, and to also have had the experience and the courage, which may not have felt like courage to you, because when you're in your own body acting as yourself, somebody seeing your action as courage is just normal for you. But to say to the person who gave the feedback, you go do it yourself, right? I think there are a lot of people listening who will be like, what? How does one even begin to do that? And how does one do that when you don't have a manager who's an advocate in that way, right? And so you're just like a little newbie trying to exist in the world, getting this heat and unsure how to figure, you know, do I change myself? And there are a lot of people who are just fully conforming in an effort to survive. So that leads me to this next question, which is everything that you described about yourself. I mean, I don't know, did you mention that you were born in Queens, that you're from Queens?
Oh, no, I was born in Brooklyn.
You were born in Brooklyn. But Queens. I experienced Elisa's, you know, I remember the first time meeting you. Elisa's short statured. Sorry, is that rude? It's 2023. I don't know what you're supposed to say. You're petite.
I think that's okay.
I think petite is accurate. It's better. You know, red hair, and just full of personality, you know, able to command an audience. And you have this, I guess, Queen's accent. But you know, in my mind, it's just like Elisa. It's inextricably linked with you. But we would be in these rooms with men and, you know, some women, but mostly men. And I was always impressed at how you can kind of command the space. But when I first met you, you had been around the block, right? So you had sort of shaped your way of navigating these spaces. But what advice might you give to somebody who, like you, maybe even like me, didn't come from the same spaces that we find ourselves in or our colleagues in, and are trying to survive without the benefit of having a mentor or a manager who can sort of help coach us through what could feel like isolating experiences, where you look around and you're like, nobody looks like me, nobody talks like me, nobody came from the same environment as me. I think I'm smart, but like I'm not, you know, I'm shaken. So what advice might you offer that person?
So when people ask for this kind of advice, I do have a caveat, and that's that you never know what the impact of your behavior is going to result in, right? So I worry about telling people to behave as I do, and then find out that they got in trouble, right? So, however, I really believe that if you're doing what you believe is the best thing for the business, right? Not the best thing for you, right? It's not about me getting promoted, but what you're, if you're doing the best thing for the business, then you have the right to speak up and provide a different perspective than the other people in the room. And I was told, because I was like a pit bull that would, grab a hold of something and not let go. And I was, the feedback I was given, which is good feedback, is, you say it once, if you're not listened to, and it doesn't mean in the same room, right? This might be in the same meeting or over time, but you rephrase it, you say it a second time, maybe you say it a third time, and then you just have to let it go, right? Because at some point you have to let it go. Although I do believe you can try to influence after the meeting, right? You can revisit something after a meeting, and you could go into the decision maker, or the level that you're most comfortable, and try again. But I do believe that they are hiring you for your thinking, and that you not only have the right, but you have the responsibility to give your point of view. And you need to do it in a way that is respectful. But I think the reason why, people say to me, how do you get away with that, right? And I look at them, because I don't even know what they're talking about, to be honest, because what you said it before, like when it's your body, you don't feel it that way. But I think I got away with it because I think people knew I was always trying to do what was best for the business. And I don't really know if this is part of my success or not, but I've always assumed that it is, that I try educating people, including people who are above me, for, in terms of why I'm doing something the way I'm doing it, or why I'm recommending the way I'm doing it. And, if you don't do it in a condescending way, it's a learning experience, for them as well. They may not do what you're saying to do, but I do think that if you are doing what you're doing because you feel it's right for the business. The other thing is that I do not believe that you can act out of fear. I think that once you start acting out of fear, it's like, it's like a dog. They can smell it on you, right? And I think you lose at that point. I really do. I think that you need to be able to wake up in the morning, look at yourself in the mirror, know that you're doing, the most you can do for what's right for the business, and that you can't be afraid. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, that was phenomenal. Honestly, it is huge to move through work without fear, but we have to acknowledge that sometimes for some people, for some groups, it is terrifying to not see yourself having, when I say yourself, anybody who looks like you or reminds you of yourself have made it. And so the brain does a thing where it's like, well, clearly maybe others tried and failed, and so I'm not even going to risk it. So the last question I have for you today is around this idea of mentorship in the organization. So, it wasn't like I saw another, Caribbean immigrant person and said, great, that's what I'm going for. In fact, throughout my career, at least early days, I wasn't very like, I wasn't overly ambitious. I think I was ambitious to get a great job done. And I think I was like excited to be promoted, but I didn't have a vision for where I could be. Some people are very clear. They're like, I want to run everything. And that wasn't me. But I wouldn't have been able to get through a lot of it if I didn't have you as somebody who, even outside of our initial time together, I could come back to and be like, this is what's going on. Because sometimes your internal voices or the voice, because you already feel like I'm the only one in my body, is all that you hear.
Right.
So sometimes you need somebody else to say, well, actually, it didn't look like that to me. Or so who was that person for you? And maybe, you know, if you don't have a person or actually, I think you do. Maybe it's several people. You've talked about like the woman who surrounded you both at Colgate and outside. But I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your experience of that support system, that whatever it was that sort of got you through. And then what you might offer as advice to people who, again, starting off, they're hearing this podcast and they're like, great, you know, this is really motivating me. But in my organization, I don't have I'm untethered. So what should their next step be to create a little bit more of that tethering? So two-part question.
So, I mean, I actually feel like I was very fortunate at Colgate because my mentors were actually Joan Brady and Joan's boss, who, you know, was ultimately my boss's boss, and Maureen. And I do feel that I learned, you know, an incredible amount from them, and that they were mentors. And so I was really, really fortunate that my boss was also a mentor. And that's not always the case. Your boss does not always take the time to mentor. They manage you, but they don't always mentor you. And I think it's far and few between to have a manager that intentionally mentors the people that work for them. And so I consider myself very fortunate about that. And if I didn't have them, I don't think I would have had anybody in my early days, actually. I really don't. I mean, the organization wasn't really set up that way. And then we did start, I don't know if you were around for this, but we did start a mentorship program. And so we assigned people. So like Kathy Thornhill became my mentor, but people were assigned to people, which I don't know that that really works. I mean, my experience for me and for my peers at Colgate was that it didn't work because it wasn't organic. You weren't talking to the person that you wanted to talk to necessarily. So, you know, if an organization is going to do a mentorship, I think they need to do it similar to, you know, a 7-minute dating roundtable where you find somebody that you click with. I think you need to click with them. But I do think that if you've got, if you see somebody that you respect and you think that they kind of, you know, not that they're just successful because they're getting promoted, but that they have wisdom to offer, corporate wisdom to offer, then you approach them and see if you could set something up. And the other thing is that I think that, I mean, I would personally choose, you know, or want to choose a woman for my mentor. But I think it's a mistake to think like if you're a female, you have to choose female, right? Because being mentored by a male might actually be better, because if your organization is primarily male, it gives you a really good perspective. And the reverse is true. If you are, you know, a male looking for mentoring, that the right mentor for you may be a female. And so I don't think that it has to be gender specific or, you know, based on ethnicity or anything, unless it's appropriate. I had a lot of women come to me of fermentering after they had children. And so how did you become a VP and have twins and work? And so that's, they needed a female for that, right? If you're Black and you feel that you're the only Black person in a room and that people may not be listening to you or seeing you, then maybe you need a Black mentor. So I think it depends on the situation. I really do think it depends on the situation. But I think it's like anything else. It's hard work. If you want a mentor, you have to work to get one.
And to keep one, as we've said in other conversations, a one-time conversation with somebody doesn't represent a mentorship relationship or a mentoring relationship. I think if somebody is making the time to give you advice, then come to them every 3 months with a question or a suggestion. And I think the same goes for the mentor. Check in. But yeah, like work with like relationships that exist outside of work, it requires work. At least I love this conversation and I want to have more of these conversations. I think that this is like a two-part series. But to close this particular segment, I would love to get some parting words from you. And really, this is for those listening who feel like a beautiful misfit at work, knowing that they have something, and as Elise said, feeling very much like they deserve to be there. They have unique thoughts and contributions, but perhaps could use a little bit of a pep talk as they navigate a space that perhaps wasn't created naturally for them to exist and thrive. So what parting words might you share with the listeners?
So my parting words would actually be the words that I spoke about before, which is about having confidence in yourself, which I know is hard, but you know, it's like a muscle, right? So if you practice it, to advocate for yourself and to speak up for yourself and to find that mentor, and to really talk to people that you trust, right? It's got to be people that you trust about how you're feeling, because the reality and what's going on in your head may be completely opposite. I have heard many people who I knew they were doing well saying, I'm going to get fired, or I'm not doing a good job. And so you have to be careful about that little voice in your head that you spoke about before. You really do. And speaking to people and advocating for yourself and getting feedback is a good way to do that. The other thing that I think is important, though, is that depending on your organization, it just might not be, they might not be the right fit for you, right? We've been talking about, you know, the organizations saying, you know, you don't fit. And that's an easy excuse for getting rid of you or not giving you what you deserve. But you can also say, this organization does not fit me, and go someplace where the organization is better for you.
Oh, what a word. What a word. What a great place to end.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this conversation between Elise and I. Thank you to Elise Kane once again for the time and the mentorship. I look forward to more of these kinds of conversations, but for now, I bid you all adieu. Please go ahead and subscribe and share this podcast to anyone who you think could benefit from it. Take care. Till next time.